Thank you, Dr. Haken, and welcome to all. It is my pleasure to welcome you to the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Boyce College, and it is particularly nice to welcome you after you've already been welcomed, I hope, by many others who are glad to see you and to have you on this campus. I'm also very pleased to be here for this conference, and I appreciate the work of the Andrew Fuller Center, Dr. Haken, and so many others who make this possible. There is a sense in which this could be nothing more than an antiquarian society of people who are interested in things Baptist and things historical, hopefully things historically Baptist. But gladly, it is more than that. We are drawn here because, as men and women of conviction in this place, we are drawn to the beliefs that are here represented and articulated. We want to associate with a faith once for all delivered. We want to stand with those who stand with the gospel. We want to be faithful in a generation that does not prize faithfulness. It is a particular pleasure to have the opportunity to speak to the importance of Baptist confessionalism, and as I begin, I must tell you that I do so as a matter of deep personal passion, because it is the story of my own sense of self and sense of stewardship of this office. It is a story that involves many twists and turns involving this institution where we are privileged to meet tonight. And it is indeed a recovery of the importance of Baptist confessionalism that explains, by God's providence, why we are meeting here to have this discussion rather than somewhere else. There are so many different ways that this most appropriate topic could be considered, but speaking to a group like this, representing a center of this assignment on the importance of Baptist confessionalism, is a challenge, first of all, in that if there is any group on this planet that is familiar with the heritage of Baptist confessionalism, it would be you gathered here in this place, and it would be this center and its work. So I thought about what contribution I might make in the context of our time tonight, and I've decided to do something a bit different. I will speak in terms of an historical survey, but I will announce in advance that it will be somewhat anecdotal and thematic, in order that I might get to a portion programmatic and speak of the importance of Baptist confessionalism in the 21st century in light of some lessons learned from Baptist experience in the past. If there is a right place for us to begin considering the importance of Baptist confessionalism, it would be in a conference like this focused upon Baptists of the 17th century. For confessionalism became very quickly a part, indeed a central part, of Baptist identity. But I want to go backwards a bit into the 16th century and into the Reformation. The responsibility of confessing the faith was hardly new. It is apostolic. It was assigned to us by the Lord Jesus Christ, repeated over and over again in the apostolic admonitions. Paul's admonitions to Timothy amount to a pristine definition and defense of confessionalism. Paul speaks so clearly of a pattern of sound words, reminding us that the gospel itself, the entire system of Christian truth, must be rightly articulated. There are right words and there are wrong words, and there are right patterns of words and there are wrong patterns of words. And that means there are true expressions of the Christian faith and there are false expressions of the Christian faith. There are healthy expressions of Christian truth and there are deadly misconceptions and misconstrued expressions of what is presented as a Christian faith. It is not merely a matter of a scholastic attempt at theological orthodoxy, as Paul makes very clear. As the New Testament affirms, it is a matter of life and death, for it is a matter of whether there is gospel or not. But in the 16th century, the great age of confessions, I think it is important for us to understand the motivation in particular for the adoption of the confession of faith as a means of establishing a dogmatic center and boundary and a doctrinal definition of the true church, for that was the issue. The great question was the identity of the true church. The great question was how the true church will be made visible in terms of doctrine, and on what basis, what authoritative basis, doctrine could be defined and articulated, boundaries could be established. That quickly took the form of confessions. These confessions were the inevitable result of the cleavage in the church in the Great Reformation. The question was where the true church was to be found. Luther clearly understood this. Calvin clearly understood this, as did the other reformers. But these magisterial reformers quickly pointed to the gospel itself, the preached word, as the location of the true church. But this required some expression, and this created a theological crisis early in the Reformation, because the church, as the Roman Catholic Church presented itself prior to the Reformation, made a universal and exclusive claim to the formulation of doctrinal principles, of doctrinal formulas. And thus, the question was how such a Reformation would take doctrinal shape without a magisterium, without the papacy, how the church, as Luther described it, as the pillar and the ground of truth, citing from the New Testament, and as Luther elaborated it, as the locus and cradle of the gospel, could establish and articulate that truth in a creedal form. The confession of faith emerged out of the reformers' ambition and determination to establish a continuity with the faith once for all delivered to the saints. The great defensive need of the reformers was to establish that their Reformation was not an innovation, but was rather a return to the true faith. In order to do that, they established doctrinal formula in order to make clear that the continuity of the faith was expressed in explicitly doctrinal terms and in doctrinal terms that could be understood by the people and expressed to the public in ways that were clearly and biblically defensible. However, the confessions of faith of the 16th century were not only the inevitable product of the Reformation, but they were also marked by the peculiarities of place and of time. And even though we today stand in the great tradition of these confessions, they were not final. The tumult of the Reformation in the 16th century led to, of course, the development of different Reformation traditions, the Lutheran tradition, and then, of course, the Reformed tradition, associated most clearly with Geneva, but also with Zurich and other cities in Switzerland and beyond. The development of the English Reformation led to an entirely different doctrinal challenge. And here, Henry VIII's break with the papacy, and thus with the Church of Rome, led to the necessity of establishing what amounted to a state-supported system of doctrine, the state thus becoming the definitional issue for the Anglican Church. By the time we get to the 17th century, and we get to English separatism, and we get to the development of the groups most clearly and rightly associated with the Baptists, by the time we have the emergence of a distinctive Baptist identity in the 17th century, the need for the Baptists was virtually the same as the need for the Reformers a century before, and that was to establish continuity with the faith once for all delivered to the saints, and against many of the same accusations that the Baptists were indeed innovators. And thus the Baptists sought to establish a very clear claim to continuity rather than innovation, to associate with the true faith, the Orthodox faith, and to do so in a way that would leave them, if not invulnerable to criticism, at least publicly associated with the great and definite doctrines of the Christian faith. Thus, by the time we move from the early 16th century all the way into the mid-17th century, we have the development of multiple creeds and confessions. All you have to do is look at the various encyclopedias of the Reformation in order to determine that the number of confessions of faith adopted here and there in different circumstances by different groups had now grown, but there are clear confessional traditions. And, of course, by the time you get to 1677 and 1689, you have a very clear identification of the British Baptist, the English Baptist tradition, with the Westminster Confession and with the Reformed tradition. All of this is informed, of course, by different confluences, and the general Baptists and the particular Baptists both had their own doctrinal formulations, but both had the same central ambition, and that was to identify themselves with the faith once delivered and to indicate, to prove, to demonstrate by argument and by confessional expression that they were not innovators, but rather that it was the churches from which they had separated that were the ones who were involved in teaching doctrinal innovation. I want to speak in particular among the Baptists after we leave the 17th century of two different issues. And the first is The development of a confessional identity among Southern Baptists, and then the development of a confessional identity within the life of this institution, the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. The Southern Baptist Convention, of course, was established in 1845. And as such, it was in a history of Baptist development that already included various confessions of faith. 1742 in the United States, the Philadelphia Confession of Faith, which was an edited version of the Westminster Confession, of course, read through the lenses of the 1689 Confession, Second London Confession, and its preface. By the time you get to 1833, there is another Confession of Faith, the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, although it appears that at least in much of the country in the early 19th century, the New Hampshire Confession of Faith was not generally known. It would become well known and very popular among Baptists in the South in the latter 19th century. By the time the Southern Baptist Convention developed and established itself in Augusta, Georgia in 1845, a confessional identity was well known and established in the churches of the South, the Baptist churches of the South. The Charleston Association, the first association in the South, adopted what it called the Century Confession, later called the Charleston Confession, which was itself a derivative of the Philadelphia Confession and the Second London Confession with roots in the Westminster tradition. Most of the churches in the South identified in the region where the churches were to be found, who were represented in Augusta, were drawn from churches with established traditions, and more importantly, from Baptist associations with established traditions, not only in Baptist confessionalism, but in the Charleston and Philadelphia tradition. However, there were others already in the South in terms of the separate Baptist tradition, and also in terms of the frontier where the New Hampshire Confession of Faith was becoming more popular. Now, this becomes evident, for instance, when churches in the territory of Florida in the mid-1800s attempt to join the Georgia Baptist Convention. And the associations that are represented in the Georgia Baptist Convention, in particular the associations of Central Georgia, which by their influence and dominance made themselves attractive to churches in the frontier. The interesting thing to be noted here, and this is documented so well by Professor Greg Wills, is that many of these associations actually took their confessionalism so seriously that they required these churches on the frontier to adopt their own confession of faith in order to be accepted as churches of like faith and practice within their associational life. In 1845, the Southern Baptist Convention established itself as a denomination, but as a denomination which was itself less structured than we might imagine. It decided upon an annual meeting rather than a triennial meeting, which had been the practice of the triennial convention out of which the convention was to be developed. That was the convention representing both the North and the South before the crisis of slavery and separatism. What we have in the development of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1845, institutionally, is the development of two mission boards, a foreign mission board and what became known as a home mission board. Fascinating thing to many of our students now is to understand where the frontier really was in 1845. It was still in Georgia. States like Alabama and Mississippi are clearly identified as frontier states in Indian territory. And the state of Kentucky also, though populated by many, including the Baptists, was still in such a frontier situation that several of the churches still existent in this county have shutters meant to be closed to keep the arrows out from Native American attack. That is a part of the history of this region and very much a part of what the Southland looked like, especially in terms of frontier areas and the borderlands in the mid-19th century. But in 1845, these two institutions, begun with little money but with great hope, were themselves considered to be autonomous in responding to the churches. Trustees were elected by the convention. The trustees represented an innovation from the triennial convention in that the Southern Baptist Convention would not directly operate and manage its mission boards, but rather would elect trustees who would do the same. This was partly a response to the necessities of travel and time and investment and financial support. But the key for our understanding of the Southern Baptist Convention and its confessional consciousness in 1845 is actually what the convention did not do rather than what it did. In the fundamental laws and organizing documents of the Southern Baptist Convention released in an address to the public, which was to explain as an apologia why the Southern Baptist Convention was necessary and why it was established, The founders of our denomination made clear, and I quote, "We take as the basis of our union no creed." So there was no creed at the center of the Southern Baptist Convention's identity as a convention, and that has led to a massive historical misrepresentation. The historical misrepresentation is that Baptists are thus a non-confessional or non-creedal people. That is true. If your sole issue of concern is the founding announcement of the Southern Baptist Convention, the motivation for that is the opposite of what it would later be construed to be. When I arrived here as a student in a very different day in the life of this institution, I was told that Southern Baptists, that Baptists in general, were completely, totally, persistently, perennially opposed to all creeds and confessions of faith, one that would have any regulative or binding authority. And this citation from the address to the public in 1845 was most often cited. The reason why that is a misconstrual is easy to understand. There was not a church represented in Augusta, Georgia, in that convention that did not have a binding confession of faith. That was not a part of an association that indeed was confessionally defined. The statement made by the Southern Baptist Convention's founders in 1845 was not meant to be an assault or slander upon confessionalism, but rather a statement of humility that the convention at the national level would not seek to supplant the confessionalism already operating at the congregational and associational level. The Southern Baptist Convention was able to function from 1845 to 1859 with absolutely no doctrinal statement undertaken by the denomination itself or by any institution associated with the Southern Baptist Convention. That would change in 1859 with the establishment of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary as a clearly confessional institution based upon a regulative confession of faith, but I will hold that for a later comment and return to the Southern Baptist Convention, which as a convention still had made no doctrinal statement, had adopted no creed or confession of faith from 1845 until 1914. In 1914, the movement for church union spread throughout the Protestant world. Originally, Southern Baptists had some hope in this movement, but as the movement began to develop, it clearly developed along ecumenical lines that Baptists considered to be unfaithful and dangerous. And even though there were some in the elite of the denomination who wanted to associate with the leadership of other denominations in some form of union or implicit union, the Southern Baptist Convention did not join this union, but instead, in 1914, adopted what was identified as the Pronouncement on Christian Union and Denominational Efficiency. Several things are flowing into one confessional cauldron here. The first is that Southern Baptists are trying to find a way to make a statement that it will be understood as positive about why the convention will not join the union movement. That is itself something of a public relations challenge. The Baptists in the South and the Southern Baptist Convention in 1914 decided to do so on the basis of claiming a distinctive identity well articulated in 8 different doctrinal statements. The last part of the title of that document, Denominational Efficiency, turns to larger currents in the culture where at the national level, efficiency was becoming the buzzword of the business culture. And as a matter of fact, efficiency becomes the concern for many of the study groups, consultations, and other movements underway in terms of measuring institutional and denominational life. The statement on Christian union and denominational efficiency basically came down to the fact that in order to maintain our denominational efficiency, the Southern Baptist Convention would not enter into any union. But in so doing, E.Y. Mullins was the hidden hand, the president of this institution and later to be president of the Southern Baptist Convention. His hand was hidden in this as he developed this statement as a way of making a distinctive but positive Baptist statement of identity without offering to the convention the necessity of adopting any confession of faith. The Southern Baptist Convention faced its first crisis along these lines during World War I. And this had to do with issues of separation of church and state and forced union, forced ecumenism. This is a chapter basically lost in American church history, but it is a necessary chapter for our understanding of Baptist confessionalism. For as we fast forward to 1925 and the adoption of the Baptist faith and message, it is true that the main reason the Baptist faith and message was adopted by the Southern Baptist Convention was the context of the fundamentalist modernist controversy. But what may be missed is the fact that the fuse that lit that particular explosion was the experience of the Southern Baptist Convention in the chaplaincy program of World War I. In World War I, the federal government, the United States government, involved in the first time of sending mass Americans overseas in a military effort, tried to consolidate ministry under military chaplaincy under the aegis of the YMCA. That is the Young Men's Christian Association, which was at that time understood to be a part of the muscular Christianity of turn-of-the-century mainstream Protestantism. But the rules that were established by the YMCA for the operation of chaplains made it virtually impossible for Baptists to operate with integrity of conscience. And thus, Southern Baptists were basically absent from the chaplaincy in World War I. This led to great resentment among the Baptists of the South. It led to no little controversy in terms of ecumenical circles. And the Southern Baptist Convention, in the experience of that chaplaincy crisis in World War I, was alerted to the fact that there were theological liberals that were operating within the mainline Protestant denominations, and that this was a hostile liberalism that indeed would make it impossible for any union effort to succeed. But furthermore, the Baptists were left, Southern Baptists in particular, were left without any confessional basis to which they could point as a defense against the move of the federal government during World War I in terms of the consolidation of the chaplaincy forces. Other denominations had confessions of faith to which they could point. The Southern Baptist Convention was rather defenseless, having adopted no official confession of faith, and furthermore, having adopted a statement declared to the public in 1845 that no confession of faith was taken as the basis of the Union. Then we come to 1919. In 1919, Southern Baptists were called upon again to come up with some kind of doctrinal formulation. And this had to do with the fact that there was an effort to recombine and reunite the Baptists of the North and the South. Talks began at the level of the elites in both denominations. Leaders of the Southern and the Northern Baptist conventions gathered in order to discuss the possibility of reuniting the two denominations. Baptists in the South suggested as a possible basis of such a union the adoption of the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. This was met with an allergic and reflexive response of the Baptists in the North, who were as anti-confessional and anti-creedal as Baptists in the South would later be alleged to be. As a matter of fact, the key issue of dating here for us is to look to 1922, when the Northern Baptist Convention refused by official vote to adopt the New Hampshire Confession of Faith as a basis, a doctrinal basis of its union. And from 1922 onward, the Northern Baptist Convention, later the American Baptist Churches USA, is resolutely non-confessional, and that explains its constant march to the left. But by 1925, just 3 years after the Northern Baptist Convention vote, Southern Baptists would have to return to the basic question of a confession of faith. But in 1919, after talks broke down between the Baptists of the North and the South, the leaders of these two conventions concerning the possibility of a reunion, the fraternal address of the Southern Baptists was presented to the Southern Baptist Convention. Interestingly, the convention was never asked to vote upon it. It was presented by the leaders as a statement. It was read and in good Baptist form was received by something like common consent. It was never, however, voted upon as an item of business on the floor of the convention. But the fraternal address of the Baptists also included several doctrinal statements. For the first time, thus, in 1914 and in 1919, Southern Baptists, while never admitting they were developing a confessional tradition or adopting a confession of faith, did adopt doctrinal statements that were intended to make the same kind of statement as a confession of faith in the 16th and 17th centuries. However, they were not considered to be regulative in the life of the denomination, partly because, as the letters and correspondence between those involved in these things made clear at the time, they saw this as an external rather than as an internal threat. The statements of 1914 and 1919 were not so much addressed to the need that was then perceived for a regulation of doctrine within the denomination's life, a protection of orthodoxy, a concern about what seminary professors and missionaries might be teaching and spreading. It was not to establish a union in terms of a theological consensus that was thought to be lacking. Rather, It was to make a public statement in 1914 about why there would be no union with other denominations, and in 1919 about why there would be no union with the Northern Baptist Convention. It is interesting, however, to note that in order to make this argument, the convention began to adopt theological statements, explicit doctrinal statements, as statements of Baptist principle and belief. The fundamentalist modernist controversy was now raging throughout the United States, and even though the South was largely protected from the ravages of that controversy, it was not without knowledge of the general context and of the issues at stake. You have, of course, notorious liberals such as Harry Emerson Fosdick at the Riverside Church in New York City, and before that at the First Presbyterian Church, where he became the center point of course, great controversy as he was ejected from that pulpit. There at the First Presbyterian Church, he had preached the sermon, Shall the Fundamentalist Win? And thus you had in the Northern denominations, Presbyterianism, and in the Northern Baptist Convention in particular, you had white-hot controversy over these issues. And as time would tell, the liberals won virtually all of those skirmishes. In the Presbyterian Church, this would lead to, of course, the development of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, the removal of J. Gresham Machen and colleagues to establish Westminster Theological Seminary. But among the Baptists, it led in a very different direction, as the Baptists in the North decided not to deal with these theological issues and indeed began their inexorable march to the left. In the South, there was no Harry Emerson Fosdick in a major pulpit. There was no Gresham Machen to lead an exodus out of the denomination and its mother seminary at Princeton. To the contrary, there was a sense that basically all was well. However, there were punctuated moments of concern, even within the Southern Baptist Convention. These moments of concern arose in locales such as Wake Forest, North Carolina, where at Wake Forest University, the president began to articulate a very clear theory of evolution and to treat the opening chapters of the book of Genesis as mythological. It emerged in other areas where, especially in Baptist colleges and in the young Baptist universities, such teachings came to light with skirmishes not only in Wake Forest on the East Coast, where it might be expected, but at Baylor University in the heart of Texas, where perhaps it would be considered less likely. By the time the convention met in 1925, the denomination was making a massive turn towards a new identity. In 1925, the Baptist Faith and Message would be adopted, but that would also be the year in which the convention would adopt its central funding formula, known then and now as the Cooperative Program. Any outside observer would look to the Memphis Convention of 1925 and see a massive consolidation of Southern Baptist identity taking shape in the institutionalized form of a newly energized denominationalism. The denomination had no central budget until 1925, even as it had no confession of faith. The convention would leave Memphis and would have developed both within a span of 2 years of preparation. Key to understanding the Baptist Faith and Message in 1925 is E.Y. Mullins. E.Y. Mullins was, as I have suggested, the hidden hand, barely hidden, we might say, behind the pronouncement on Christian union and denominational efficiency in 1914 and behind the fraternal address of the Southern Baptists in 1919. As a matter of fact, he is the hidden hand behind virtually every denominational document of this period of Baptist life. But E.Y. Mullins became the chairman of the committee to develop what became known as the Baptist Faith and Message. The committee was not assigned the task of developing the confession. The convention assigned to the committee the task of coming up with a means of ensuring the theological unity of the denomination. The committee then chose the means of a confession of faith. When the Baptist Faith and Message was adopted by the convention in 1925, it is recognized as directly derivative of the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, which raises an interesting question. What happened in the Baptist churches of the South between, say, the mid-19th century and the early 20th century that the basis of union would be not directly related to the Philadelphia and Charleston confessions, but rather to New Hampshire? That is made all the more interesting when the New Hampshire Confession is basically invisible for much Baptist life in the South until just before this took place. This leads to the key role played by Baron Stowe. And he wrote a Baptist minister's manual, which in the late 19th century became indispensable to Baptist ministers throughout the South as well as the North. And in it, he published certain documents that were central to Baptist church life. And one of these was a confession of faith. That confession of faith was the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. And thus, proximity being very important, when these Baptist pastors picked up their minister's manual, the confession of faith was the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. And the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, being a modified Calvinism, considerably modified from that of the Philadelphia and Charleston traditions, became very popular on the frontier, especially in places such as Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. And by the time the convention gathered together, it attracted also the allegiance of E.Y. Mullins. For in 1912, E.Y. Mullins had written a little book entitled What Baptists Believe. And it's now published as Baptist Beliefs. And in this little volume, he took as his task to provide an exposition of the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. In 1925, the convention debated with considerable ferocity, but with growing unity, the need for a confession of faith and adopted it overwhelmingly. There ensued a debate as to what the convention had actually done. The convention's committee, headed by E.Y. Mullins, not only presented a derivative of the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, and thus a modified version of a modified confession of faith, but it did so defensively with a lengthy preamble, which serves kind of as an address to Southern Baptists about how the confession of faith is and is not to be understood. The defensiveness of that document indicates again that there was concern about centralization and consolidation of power and authority within the National Convention at the expense of the state conventions, associations, and congregations. Later generations would be able to look back to 1925 and see that basic defensiveness as also the ground in which a very fertile seed of doctrinal aberration would begin to grow. The Baptist faith and message adopted in 1925 functioned within the denomination's life as a symbol in the truest meaning of the word. It became a document which by indication pointed to the beliefs of the Baptists associated with the Southern Baptist Convention, those churches who would send messengers to the Southern Baptist Convention, and by their gifts would be considered in friendly cooperation with and contributing to the causes of the denomination. In other words, the 1925 statement was seen more or less as descriptive rather than as regulative. The lack of a regulative function for the Baptist faith and message led to controversy immediately following the 1925 convention, and thus the adoption, just a year later, of the McDaniel Resolution, which was an attempt to make at least the statements against evolution that were considered to be implicit in the Baptist faith and message, now explicit in this resolution, binding upon those who would teach within the denomination's schools. The schools were then required to respond by the convention's positive vote for the McDaniel Resolution concerning the teachings on the campus. However, it is a matter now of Baptist record that the schools basically failed to respond in any meaningful way to the convention's inquiry and demand in the years of the late 1920s. The Southern Baptist Convention was, as historians have suggested, at ease in Zion during the period of the early and mid-20th century. There was little doctrinal controversy within the life of the denomination. The controversies, which are revealed by a study of state papers and other primary sources of the day, instead of pointing to clearly doctrinal issues, point to issues of applied ecclesiology, issues related to landmarkism and attendant controversies, issues related to the life of churches in terms of the social issues of the day, controversies over institutional and denominational matters from the funding of missionaries to the relationship between the state and national convention bodies, but virtually no sustained theological controversy until the early 1960s. In the 1950s, and especially in the period 1945 to 1960, the Southern Baptist Convention experienced its most explosive growth. This was, of course, not only true of the Southern Baptist Convention, but of much of the United States of America. As in the post-war period, there's an enormous boom of economic energy, of a population explosion with the birth rate skyrocketing in the post-war years. Southern Baptists would adopt the slogan in 1953, famous now, a million more in 54. And as later historians will be able to recount, Southern Baptists failed to meet the goal But we're so busy bragging about it, no one noticed at the time. But in the early 1960s, the seamless peace of the Southern Baptist Convention in terms of theological continuity began to fall apart. Those who were aware of what was going on within the life, especially of its theological seminaries and related colleges and universities, would have perceived this for some time, but by the early 1960s, it is undeniable. For in this period, there emerges controversy centered in especially the historicity of the book of Genesis. Ralph Elliott, an instructor at this institution, later a professor at the newly birthed Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, published a book entitled The Message of Genesis. And in this book suggested that the early chapters of Genesis, and perhaps the entire book, were not to be taken as historical record in any sense, and thus were not falsifiable as historical records in any sense. Suggested that Melchizedek was a pagan priest, and among other teachings, suggested that the book of Genesis needed to be completely reinterpreted in light of contemporary archaeological data and literary research. Now, that book, very interestingly, in terms of its controversy, was a surprise to those who thought they understood the Southern Baptist Convention. One of the interesting issues in terms of a survey of the primary documents indicates that the parties to this controversy never understood where they had started until it was over. They thought that Southern Baptists in this period were so concerned with attaining a new level of educational identity and public respectability that the convention was ready to tolerate such teachings and to accept them as the necessary outcome of higher educational status and identification with the mainstream culture. That turned out hardly to be true. However, in 1962, when the convention set about to revisit the question of a confession of faith in a clearly defensive posture, this time not concerned with forces from the outside, as was true in 1925, but now far more concerned with matters inside, it is clear that the denomination found a way through its committee process to avoid dealing with the underlying theological issues. The convention's reflex was to try in the 1960s what had appeared to work in the 1920s. The fundamentalist modernist controversy was largely papered over in the South rather than confronted directly by the adoption of the 1925 Baptist Faith and Message. The adoption of the 1963 Baptist Faith and Message, however, had no such effect on the Southern Baptist Convention. As a matter of fact, the 1963 statement was conducted by those who, like in 1925, were insiders, but unlike the 1925 committee, the 1963 committee included virtually no one who would bring a more conservative voice within the process of the formulation of the proposal. As a matter of fact, the members of the committee were the elected presidents of the various state conventions who were by definition insiders, and Dr. Herschel Hobbs himself chaired the process, and Dr. Hobbs, who was one of the most influential Baptists of the 20th century and was himself a conservative who had friendly conversation with New Orthodoxy, he saw this as a means of avoiding a confrontation that he thought would be deadly and disastrous for the denomination. The denomination's leadership and elite at this point, we must note, saw the forward momentum of the denomination as that one thing to be protected at all costs, even if this included the avoidance of dealing with theological issues, which they themselves knew might one day require a more direct address. In 1963, the convention adopted the Baptist Faith and Message. And by the way, in official parlance, it's always just the Baptist Faith and Message. Whatever the convention says the Baptist Faith and Message is, that's what it is. We have to refer to 25 and 63 and 2000 in order to know which document to which we make reference. But if we now say we adopt the Baptist Faith and Message, that actually means 2000. But that's a matter lost on some people. Nonetheless, in 1963, the document was revised. And in the revision of the document, it clearly embraced a neo-Orthodox understanding of Scripture. Scripture becomes a witness rather than the direct, propositional, objective, verbal Word of God. There were other changes, of course, that took place within the 1963 statement. The anti-ecumenism, which had fueled the 1914 and 1919 statements, was largely reversed by a statement on cooperation, which in principle included a doctrinal prohibition against false and wrongful cooperation, but in principle did not keep the elite of the denomination from associating with virtually any group, including study committees that cooperated with the National and World Council of Churches. In 1925, it appeared that the remedy of a confession of faith would maintain the denominational peace. In the 1960s, it was clear this was not the case. You can fast forward from 1963 to 1969, and once again, the denomination is involved in controversy, this time even more vehement and heated and pointed than in the early 1960s, and in this case, over a commentary series published by the denomination's Central Publishing House, the Sunday School Board. In this case, special attention was directed to Volume 1 by Hinton Davies, British Baptist scholar, who argued basically everything that Ralph Elliott had argued in the early 1960s in his book, The Message of Genesis. The convention required the Sunday School Board to revise and to publish a new edition of Volume 1, and thus it turned to a professor in this institution who wrote basically what Hinton Davies had written, what was basically what Ralph Elliott had argued. Conservatives in the denomination found themselves stymied at every turn, pushing for a confession of faith that got a confession of faith that gave away more than it retained, pressing for a modification in the biblical commentary. They ended up with a commentary that was better camouflaged, but no less neo-orthodox than the one it replaced. In 1969, the convention president was Dr. W.A. Criswell, himself a conservative, an avowed opponent of the theological aberrations he detected not only in Eliot, but in the Baptist colleges and universities. And here he was a firsthand witness to much of this, in particular at Baylor, but also in the Broadman Bible Commentary. But W.A. Criswell was also himself a part of the elite of the denomination, and even though his convictions were clearly conservative, his appointments were not. We can fast forward to the conservative resurgence in the Southern Baptist Convention that came to public light, especially in 1979 with the election of Adrian Rogers as president of the Southern Baptist Convention. And it is interesting to note that in the early years of the conservative resurgence, the effort was made over and over and over again to argue that the professors then teaching in the seminaries, many of them were outside the parameters established by the Baptist Faith and Message, that being the statement, of course, revised in 1963. So in other words, the convention revised its statement in 1963, adopting a more clearly neo-orthodox language than the far more conservative language of the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, only to find that by the late 1970s, this neo-orthodox language was itself more conservative than what was being taught in many of the colleges and universities, and including also the seminaries. The conservative resurgence in the Southern Baptist Convention was, as historian John Shelton Reed of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill says, a pitchfork rebellion, in which case the laity and local church pastors forced upon the denomination a process of change that was clearly, consistently, and strongly opposed by the elite leadership of the denomination. By 1990, conservatives have elected a succession of conservative presidents who, through the appointive powers of the presidency, are remolding the denomination through the election of trustees in the various institutions. However, even well into the 1990s, doctrinal issues continued to be debated without any adequate confessional basis of adjudication. Thus, in 1999, motion was made in 1998, but acting upon convention's wishes, President Paige Patterson, then of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, elected president of the Southern Baptist Convention, was authorized to establish a committee in order to revisit the Baptist faith and message with the eye towards a reformulation or revision of the Baptist faith and message in light of contemporary challenges. Now, here I'll speak very, very personally. I was very troubled by this. I was troubled by this because I wanted to see the Baptist faith and message revised in order to delete the neo-orthodox language and to, more importantly for my eye, immediately remove the defensive language of the preamble so that we would not inoculate ourselves against a regulative use of the confession. But also, I was concerned because, given the volatility of the day and, quite frankly, the risk of bringing anything to the fore of the Southern Baptist Convention, I was afraid that in a moment of fervor or misunderstanding, the convention might do more injury than good in terms of revising the Baptist faith and message. However, I must say with hindsight that we should be very thankful that in that moment it was clearly a providential opportunity to revisit what later might have become even more difficult in terms of the Baptist faith and message, because even as Southern Baptists were concerned with the inerrancy controversy and various theological issues, including open theism, at that point in the late 1990s, little did we know that early in the 21st century we would be dealing with a host of new issues as a new generation emerged, pun intended, with a new set of doctrinal issues that also must be addressed. The committee that presented the Baptist Faith and Message in 2000, of which I was a member, judiciously adjudicated the question and went through the articles of the Baptist Faith and Message one by one. It's interesting, the committee went immediately to the articles rather than to the introductory materials. The articles were dealt with in terms of revision before returning to the introductory materials, and it was interesting, I think it's now safe to say, that there was more agreement about the articles, even on the committee making the recommendation in 2000, than about the introductory materials. There was still a reluctance on the part of some on the committee, even in the year 2000, to remove the language which made it more difficult to apply the Baptist faith and message in a regulative fashion. And part of that was just a holdover of the sense of the tradition established not in the 17th century, not in the 18th century, but especially early in the 20th century and then coming to full bloom at the midpoint of that century. By the year 2000, Southern Baptists had adopted a newly revised Baptist faith and message. And thus, in the year 2000, a confession of faith, which was originally adopted by Baptists in New Hampshire in 1833, had been revised, and once more revised in order to be presented to a convention in order to meet the theological challenges of the early 21st century. I'd love to have the time to walk through article by article in terms of the changes between the 1963 and the 2000 statement, but suffice it to say that central attention was given to the doctrine of Scripture, where the New Orthodox language was removed, and to the doctrine of God, where a clear statement of exhaustive divine knowledge is asserted, and to other statements where there were particular needs for a clarity of language and expression. And there were some significant theological issues that did arise with these other issues and articles. However, the central issues of concern were, of course, those related to Scripture and to the exclusivity of the gospel, and to documents revised in the late 1990s, in particular, the addition of Article 18 on the family, which clearly articulated a definition of family, a normative pattern of human sexuality, and the rest. Now, very interestingly, in preparation and research for this, I was going through the centennial volume of the Philadelphia Baptist Association, and in the expositions there, I was reminded of the fact that the Philadelphia Confession included a separate article on marriage, something I had not remembered, quite frankly, as I looked at that. But, of course, its derivation from Westminster would make that clear. And the need of the Westminster divines to come up with a definition of marriage was against not only the background of what were perceived to be wrongful claims of the Roman Catholic Church to be able to dissolve unions, but also the experience of the English royal house in terms of confused questions over marriage. I'll leave that to other historians and the soap operas. The important issue for us in terms of considering the confessional identity among Southern Baptists is that by the year 2000, the convention would adopt a statement of faith that this time was clearly understood to be addressed not so much externally as in 25, nor merely internally as in 63, but simultaneously both internally and externally in the year 2000. There were perceived threats both within and without. But before I leave 2000, I must say that the language introducing the basic confession of faith was modified, but the logic was not reversed. The current introductory statements to the 2000 BFNM leave it unclear as to whether the denomination intends this to be used as a regulative document. And this because I would argue that even now the Southern Baptist Convention is not sure as to whether, as a confessional people, it intends for this confession to be completely regulative within the life of the denomination. However, in conventions in 2001, 2002, 2003, and with the response of various boards of trustees, it became apparent that the pressure, real or perceived by the denomination, and I believe it was more real than perceived, was for the institutions whose trustees were elected by the Southern Baptist Convention to adopt the Baptist Faith and Message 2000 with a clearly regulative function. The greatest controversy attendant to this was not the seminaries, where this was automatically expected, but rather the International Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention, which had been restructured and renamed in 1995, and which until this point had never required its missionaries to sign an oath of allegiance to a confession of faith. This led to the resignation of a handful of missionaries currently serving then on the field, but led to the early retirement of several others, the precise numbers unavailable to us. I want to speak of the development of a confessional identity within the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. This school was established in 1859, and the point I made earlier is that as this school was established, it clearly was established in a regulative confessional identity. So here in Louisville, Kentucky, although established first in Greenville, South Carolina, there was an institution that from the very beginning had a clear claim to a regulative confession of faith. The background of that is itself instructive. It can be traced directly to Princeton Theological Seminary and the influence of Professor Samuel Miller at Princeton upon James Pettigrew Boyce, the central founder of this institution. Given controversies over creedal subscription in the Presbyterian Church, Samuel Miller delivered a series of lectures in the 1830s and 1840s, which later took published form under the title The Use and Utility of Creeds and Confessions. To his classes in practical and pastoral theology at Princeton Theological Seminary, Miller communicated the absolute necessity of a clear confessional identity and of a regulative confessional function within the life of the school, within the life of a church, or within the life of a denomination. James Pettigrew Boyce, when he would in 1856 deliver his famous address on three changes in theological institutions, his inaugural address at Furman University, it would become the Magna Carta of this institution. He included among those changes the fact that there needed to be a clearly confessional identity of any school established for Southern Baptists, not by the Southern Baptist Convention, but for Southern Baptists for the training of its ministers. There is another line of also that also fed into the regulative functioning of the abstract of principles, as our confession is known, within the life of the institution that had to do with a father and son duo. Basil Manley Sr. became the first president, as it was then known, and later chairman of the board of trustees of this institution. He had been the pastor to young James Pettigrew Boyce in the First Baptist Church of Charleston, and his son, Basil Manley Jr., became one of the four founding members of the faculty and the primary architect of the abstract of principles. Basil Manley Sr. allowed Basil Manley Jr., upon his call to ministry, to leave Charleston and to go to Newton, Massachusetts, to study in the Newton Theological Institute, which was then the most widely recognized Baptist school of theology and divinity in the United States. However, young Basil Manley Jr. found his time at the Newton Theological Institute to be considerably difficult. His father was alarmed on more than one ground. Sectionalism was beginning to divide Baptists in the North and the South, even in this period, and there was considerable attention to the issues dividing Northerners and Southerners. But Basil Manley Sr. perceived in the communications he received from Basil Manley Jr. the presence of aberrant theological teachings on the part of those who were the professors in that Baptist institution. This alarm led Basil Manley Sr. to write Basil Manley Jr. and suggest that he must leave Newton and go to Princeton. In other words, to leave a Baptist school in order to go to a Presbyterian school. The logic of Basil Manley Sr. became clear when he said that it would be better to study among paedo-baptists who have a confession of faith rather than among Baptists who do not. Thus, the confessionalism that became the root and branch of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in its founding was one that was grounded in the experience, both in terms of the absence of confessionalism among Baptists in the North and the presence of it through a convincing argument made by Presbyterians at Princeton. But also, it was, of course, nurtured in the fact that a regulative function of the associations, of the confessions, was common to the life of the associations. It was expected and mandated within the life, for instance, of the Charleston Association, and no less, though somewhat modified in its form, in the Sandy Creek Association, which was also clearly concerned with the preservation of right doctrine and with the confession of the one true faith. When the school was established in 1859, its fundamental laws included, within the very structure of the constitution of the school, the doctrinal principles known as the abstract of principles. This document is itself a derivation of Philadelphia and Charleston and, of course, the Second London Confession and Westminster. It is clearly understood in terms of its theological tradition, and it was adopted unanimously by those who established this school as a non-controversial but binding and regulative assertion of what was to be expected of those who would teach in this institution. The language used by James Pettigrew Boyce concerning creedal subscription is drawn almost entirely from the words and the logic of Samuel Miller. As Dr. Boyce argued, the freedom of the professor is not impinged upon by the function of a regulative confession of faith. He freely signs it. Thus, he is freely obligating himself to it. It does not abrogate his freedom, but rather ties his integrity to a specific list of definite doctrines which are to be taught. Using the language of not only historic creedal and confessional subscription in the English tradition, but of the taking of oaths within the English common law tradition, Boyce wrote into the original founding documents of this seminary the fact that each professor was to sign this statement of faith ex animo. That is to say, without hesitation or mental reservation, agreeing to teach all that is contained therein. This represents something which would be indispensable to the life of this institution in the 1990s in a period of theological correction. Every professor is to teach in accordance with and not contrary to all that is contained therein, and every teacher who has taught in this institution from 1859 to the present has either been elected upon that premise, publicly established, or has signed, as a matter of contract, this confession of faith. Now, just to make matters as succinct as possible, we must state the obvious, and that is that between 1859 and 1990, there was a considerable theological development within the life of this institution. Matters that would include neo-orthodoxy, but would go far further into process theology, liberation theology, revisionist theology, and post-liberal theology, all of these had taken ground within this institution in open defiance of the will of the Southern Baptist Convention. The only means of recovery available to this institution in the 1990s was a return to the regulative function of the confession of faith and to a clearly confessional identity. By the grace of God, that was accomplished during the 1990s. But it is interesting in retrospect to note just how rare and isolated this case is in church history. The step undertaken by the Southern Baptist Convention in the year 2000 to revise its confession of faith resulted in what has happened in virtually no other denomination or denominational tradition, and that is that a revised confession of faith is more clearly conservative than that which it replaced. Likewise, the confessional reorientation of the institutions of the Southern Baptist Convention, to a greater and lesser extent and to greater and lesser controversy and publicity, represents something that is virtually solitary in terms of the experience of the Christian church, certainly in terms of American Protestantism. And there is, another example of that, it would be that which took place in the Missouri Synod Lutheranism about 8 years before what hit the Southern Baptist Convention. But the trajectory of Missouri Synod Lutheranism has not been smoothly conservative since that time, and they're involved right now in yet another controversy which may eventually threatened to be as disruptive as was the first. We must hope that there will be forces within the Missouri Synod that will be able to hold fast to a regulative confessionalism, lest all that was gained in that painful conflict be lost. And we must pray that the same will be true in the Southern Baptist Convention, lest all that is gained here by so much cost be lost. I want to make 6 very quick points, just as I'm among you in conclusion and applying some of the lessons learned from all of this. The first is that confessions of faith are necessary but not sufficient. The Southern Baptist Convention's action in 1925 and in 1963 clearly meant that the denomination was adopting a confession of faith. That was necessary, but in itself it was not sufficient, for where there is the means and the will lacking, to make the Confession of Faith regulative and to make institutions and its employees accountable to the Confession of Faith, it is merely symbolic rather than substantial. It is indicative rather than regulative. Second, confessions of faith are double-edged instruments. They always work in two directions. They always fulfill at least two functions. Reducing this to the bare minimum, they are both positive and negative. That is to say, they establish both a criterion for positive assertion of belief, as well as they isolate that which is unacceptable. The principle to keep in mind here is that heresy precedes orthodoxy. And therefore, in every confession of faith and in every revision of a confession of faith, you can read implicitly the heresies of the time, new and old, that prompted this particular revision. And by the way, the 2000 Baptist Faith and Message is no different. There's no way that the committee would have been led to make a statement, for instance, asserting the biblical necessity of exhaustive foreknowledge had not open theism emerged in the previous decade as a common teaching in some circles. Now, the same thing is true when I'm asked continually, why did Southern Baptists decide in the late 1990s to insert the sinfulness of homosexuality in a confession of faith? My response is, no one needed to say that in 1963, much less in 1925. I raise that point in order to say that we must be comfortable with the fact that a confession of faith must fulfill both of these functions. If we feel discomfort in what is perceived to be the negative function or the more polemical function, then we fail to understand how a confession of faith must operate within the life of the church. Third, confessions of faith must be developed, revised, and elaborated within new contexts in order to face new challenges. We must always keep the balance in this between what can be assumed and what must be articulated. And this has become clear in the experience of the Southern Baptist Convention, and by extension you can see this elsewhere. There are some things we can safely assume of each other. There are other things which simply must be articulated. And at any given time, in any specific theological context, that balance may fall in a different place. And for that reason, every confession of faith must be continually revisited in order to make certain that we are not assuming what can no longer be assumed, that we are indeed stating by elaboration what must be now articulated. Fourth, confessions of faith are statements of doctrinal priority. This is by no means, there's a difference between a systematic theology and a confession of faith. There's a difference between a confession of faith and a catechism. There's a difference between a confession of faith and the kind of biblical preaching that takes place in the pulpit. A confession of faith is necessarily reductionistic, but by its very reductionism, it is therefore a statement of doctrinal priority. And about that, we must also be unembarrassed. But as we understand that it is a statement of doctrinal priority, again, this requires us to go back again and again to make certain that the priority is where we believe in terms of biblical reflection and prayer and concern that it must be. Lastly, and six, Baptist confessions must be understood in different contexts. We must understand Baptist confessions in an individual sense, in terms, for instance, of the responsibility of a professor within an institution like this to sign the Confession of Faith as a pledge concerning his teaching and accountability. We must also understand the congregational context, the denominational context. And here is where Southern Baptists clearly have much work to do. And I am not a prophet, nor am I the son of a prophet, but I believe I can safely say that perhaps the greatest strains within the life of the Southern Baptist Convention in years to come will be when the convention itself must come to a mature understanding of just how regulative the Baptist faith and message must be, even in defining the membership of the denomination. Because given some of the issues now prevalent in the culture and given some of the temptations to which many churches are succumbing, it is not only now something that we can envision, it is something we now must see as virtually unavoidable, that eventually this convention is going to have to take action. It is interesting to note that in terms of such punitive action and disciplinary action, to date the convention has removed membership from two churches that had taken steps to normalize the practice of homosexuality. You can hardly imagine that given the historic membership of the Southern Baptist Convention, that those two churches will not be joined by many others that will come to the denomination's attention in years to come. And of course, on other doctrinal issues, very much the same thing. Just to give a little footnote here, if you just look at the loss, for instance, of confidence in the exclusivity of the gospel in terms of younger evangelicals, you can clearly see that this kind of doctrinal issue is going to require the convention to decide whether or not that actually is essential to what it would mean to be in cooperation with the Southern Baptist Convention and its churches. So that is a storm that we see coming. But then there's also the institutional setting, and this is the life in particular that I have lived for the last 15 years. And in the institutional settings of the Southern Baptist Convention, we've probably learned most quickly, if with greatest cost, what Baptist confessionalism really means. The great issue for us now is teaching and training and encouraging a new generation into the reality of what it means to be a faithful Christian, to fulfill the stewardship of the gospel, and of course, the stewardship of faithfulness. As the Apostle Paul said to Timothy, we are to guard the treasure that has been entrusted to us. We are to pass on that pattern of sound words and retain it. That is the essence of creedal subscription. That's the essence of confessionalism. That's the essence of the transmission of the Christian faith. Thank you, and God bless you.